everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm Kristen Watson of Iowa City Human Rights, and this is the latest of our monthly LEMS programs. It's called Disability and Language. And to find upcoming programs and sign up for notifications, please visit the Human Rights page on the Iowa City website. It's icgov.org. A few housekeeping details before we get started. There will be two opportunities for questions. So please put your questions in the Q&A box as you think of them. Please don't use the chat. The Q&A box is far easier for me to monitor and respond to. So please use Q&A. And if you can, if you cannot type or have trouble typing, please raise your hand and we'll get to your question that way. The program is being recorded and will be posted on City Channel 4 within the next 2 to 3 weeks. So that's our cable TV public access channel, also available from the city website. Slides will be available on request. You can email me. I will put my email in the chat. And if you request the slides, I will be able to send them to you. And as always, the views expressed in this program are those of the presenter and not the official policy or position of the City of Iowa City. So that said, we're very excited to have Dr. Margaret Price here to speak with us. Dr. Price is a professor of English at The Ohio State University, where they also direct the Disability Studies program. Dr. Price has written the award-winning book Script Space Time. Here it is. and Matt at school and is the recipient of a Fulbright grant. They're currently working on a project focused on cognitive disability gathering and collective access. So, welcome, Dr. Price.
Thank you so much, Kristen, and thank you everyone for being here. I see we have 87 attendees. That's incredibly exciting. I want to thank the City of Iowa City, the Office of Human Rights, and the LENS program particularly. I think it's just a wonderful idea to have an idea where people can gather and come together to talk about issues of interest. And as someone currently writing a book on gathering, this kind of opportunity to come together and just think about stuff, learn stuff, talk about stuff, is becoming increasingly rare. So I'm especially honored to be here. As Kristen mentioned, we are going to have two opportunities for Q&A. I'm going to first speak for about 15 minutes, giving sort of a general overview about disability and language. And we're then going to pause for about 10 minutes to see if questions are bubbling up. We're going to limit that middle Q&A section to about 10 minutes. And then I'll be talking about some more sort of deep dive topics, like some detailed issues around disability and language that I think are of particular interest. And then at the end, we'll have another approximately 10 minutes for some more Q&A. As Kristen mentioned, the slides are available. I've asked her to email them because I prefer my slide decks not be posted publicly places. They usually contain photographs that I took personally, or the information was meant to be presented in context. So that's why I'm asking folks to email Kristen for those. And also, as she mentioned, if you'd like to add questions, put those in the Q&A, or if you're unable to type into the Q&A, you also have the option of raising your hand on Zoom. You probably know where the raise hand feature is located, but just in case, it's at the bottom of your Zoom screen, and it should be available in the middle menu, which will either say reaction settings or raise hand. I'm now going to go ahead and share the first part of this slide deck and go ahead and get started. Now, on this cover slide, is an image that I took several years ago at the Society for Disability Studies conference. In the background is a presenter, one of our keynote presenters, Mimi Cook. And in the foreground is a sign interpreter who's signing dynamically with both hands upraised. The title of the presentation is Disability and Language, A Brief Introduction. I have my own name on there, Dr. Margaret Price, today's date. And I've also put the URL for my personal website. The URL, which I'll read out, is http://. Margaret Price, all one word, .wordpress.com. And on that website, you can find just sort of, honestly, it's kind of a grab bag. It's not really a beautiful professional website. It's more like, here's some details on empirical studies I've conducted. Here's a list of disability pedagogy resources. Here's my bio. Here's some thoughts about knitting. So feel free to browse or not as you prefer. Two of the items on that site that are possibly of interest are my two books. One is titled Mad at School: Rhetorics of Mental Disability and Academic Life. That was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2011. And my more recently out book is titled Crip Space Time: Access, Failure, and Accountability in Academic Life. That was published in 2024 by Duke University Press. And Crip Space Time is available open access. So if you go to the website for the book, there's a link you can click that takes you directly to a PDF of the whole book. Now, today, I'm not talking about more esoteric and scholarly stuff that's in those books. I'm talking more about the issue of disability and language in a broader way. So, in what ways might this topic be of interest to disabled people in all kinds of professions and situations, parents, friends, loved ones, caregivers, just people who have an interest generally? So the first two things I'm going to mention are first, what disability studies is. It's a particular academic discipline, and one of the things that we study is disability and language. And then I'm going to talk about some of the key issues that we often encounter when we're thinking about disability and language. So, first, what is disability studies? The screenshot that's on the slide you're looking at or have access to now is a screen grab from a larger website that I've built out for disability instructors who I train every year to teach disability studies classes. This is one of the first pages of that site, and it's titled Disability Studies Concepts and Principles. This is actually a longer list. I think there's about 11 items on the list, but there are four that felt especially important to me to mention during this particular seminar on disability and language. First, there's no right and wrong language for disabilities, with one important exception, which is slurs. Don't use slurs. Don't use hate speech. Other than that, really no wrong way to go about it. Some key areas to explore include person first versus disability first language, plain language, disability metaphors, and the use of capitalization for identities such as deaf, autistic, or mad. Those are all key areas that I'm going to say a bit more about in today's presentation. I also include in italics a heads up for users of the website, which is this website uses the terms disabled people and people with disabilities interchangeably. Before I continue reading this list, I want to offer a very short story about why I have this paragraph very first on this instructional website. The reason is that the term disabled people versus people with disabilities is an emotional difference. Some people feel emotionally and very strongly that people with disabilities is the right, proper, and respectful way to refer to people with disabilities. Other people feel exactly the same way about the term disabled people. Typically, in my experience, I have found that as long as I announce right up front, I'm going to be using both, that generally at least gives people the understanding that they're being heard and recognized. But if I launch directly into my own preferred language, which is usually disabled people, for example, I am a disabled person, I find that sometimes my audience might feel immediately alienated, uncomfortable, or just unsure of whether I'm aware that there's an issue to be acknowledged here. So, although I have just said there's no right and wrong language for disabilities, I do think it's usually helpful to acknowledge right up front, hey, I know there's a lot going on here. Here's the language I'm using. I want to be as respectful as possible. Three other principles that are not directly about disability and language, but that are very important to the study of disability. Centering the perspectives, voices, and work of disabled people. This does not mean centering those who are related to or friends with disabled people, much as we might love those folks. So, a very common tendency that I see sometimes among people who are teaching disability-related classes is to bring in parents, friends, writers about people who are non-disabled but have some direct relationship with disability. That's a really important standpoint. However, it is not the same standpoint as being a person who is disabled, who has a disability. And so I do want people who are teaching disability studies to be aware of that difference. Some common tropes that relate to disability and that often play into the language we use about disability include people with disabilities as pitiable, wondrous, in need of fixing, inspirational, suffering, or kind of magical, possessed of special talents because of their disabilities. So we see this a lot in mass media coverage. You'll often see the phrase wheelchair bound. Someone is wheelchair bound instead of being a person who uses a wheelchair. You'll also often see the word suffer. So and so is suffering with an illness. Maybe they are suffering, maybe they're not. But it doesn't necessarily mean just because someone has an illness or disability that they are definitely suffering. So to say that someone suffers from a disability packages those concepts together in a way that is often not helpful. And then finally, another caveat that I offer instructors of disability studies is assume there are disabled people in your classroom, working as your colleagues, and among your friends and family. At the same time, be aware that people make their own choices about whether or how to identify as disabled. So just because someone has a disability similar to one of my disabilities, for example, I have a couple of different cognitive disabilities. Just because I choose to say I'm cognitively disabled doesn't mean that someone with my exact same diagnoses would make that same choice. There are no right answers, again, in terms of how people might want to identify or what their sense of privacy or advocacy might be. And so, although it's very helpful to go looking for best practices or what's the best thing for me to do, typically there is not a rule book that doesn't start with, well, it depends. It's contextual. That doesn't mean there's nothing you can do at all. We will talk more about that. But it does mean if you're looking for the right way to act in every situation, there probably isn't one. Now, let me talk about some of these are sort of greatest hits issues regarding disability and language. These are questions I'm often asked when I'm presenting about what I call mental disability, for example, or just when I'm presenting on disability in general. As I mentioned when I was talking about training disability studies instructors, self-identification is highly variable. It may include someone's choice, but to be referred to as person with a disability versus disabled person. It could include community-specific terms like neurospicy. That's one that I'm seeing on TikTok a lot lately. It could include the choice to capitalize one's disability identity. For example, to say, I'm capital A autistic, I'm capital M mad, I'm capital D deaf. Now, each of those capitalization choices means something different vis-a-vis the community or communities it refers to. But in general, capitalizing one of these identities means that there is a cultural affiliation here. It's not referring to someone's, for example, audiological abilities or whether they have received an official medical diagnosis from a particular kind of doctor. Rather, it's pointing to a culture of disability or a community and saying, I am affiliated with, I am part of that community. Another key issue that comes up all the time is, well, how do I refer to other people? How do I know what the right term is? A recent conversation that I got into with one of my colleagues in the English department was regarding the term dwarf versus little person versus person of short stature. This particular colleague is a scholar of early American literature, and he was working with a primary text that used the word midget. He wrote me an email and said, I'm pretty sure this is not a cool word to be using repeatedly in my book, which is going to be published in 2026. However, it is the book the original author used. What term should I use? Unfortunately, I had to give this colleague the very frustrating response I often give my students, and that depends. But I was able to tell him what it depends on and where to go looking for more information. For example, he was working on a text that's several hundred years old. Therefore, the word, for example, person of short stature, that phrase, probably wasn't available at the time. There were different terms being used. So historical specificity is one of the factors he needed to take into account when he tried to write about this character who had been labeled a particular way in the primary text he was studying. Another thing he needed to take into account was what are the experts saying? I, Margaret, am not an expert in early American literature, but there are people who work on disability in early American literature. It's actually an incredibly busy and vibrant field. So go to them. There, one person, Margaret, who happens to study contemporary rhetoric, one person is not the expert on all things disability related, but they might be able to point you to someone who is. And that brings me to the third point here. The way that groups are named is always evolving. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorder, or DSM, is a great example of this. Particular diagnoses come and go as this particular diagnostic manual evolves through the decades of medical and psychiatric diagnoses. The term sexual orientation disturbance, loosely meaning homosexuality, was in the DSM up until 1973. Then it was removed. The R word, which is now a severe enough slur that I actually no longer articulate it, was commonly used in medical and popular contexts, I would say up until about 15 years ago. I've been teaching at the college level for about 30 years. Up until about 2005, 2010, I had to explicitly ask students not to use the R word in the classroom. It has now all but disappeared. The phrase autistic spectrum disorder is used in the most current edition of the DSM, which is the DSM-5TR, but it has actually had all kinds of different manifestations and subcategories over the years of that evolution. So just as medical terms tend to evolve over time, so do community and colloquial terms. The term CRIP, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, is one example. And then finally, there's the question of figures of speech. Is it uncool for me, Margaret, as a person who walks, to say to my friend who's using a wheelchair, hey, you want to go for a walk? Is it uncool for me to say, oh, yeah, I see what you mean? Is it bad to say, wow, that's crazy, or this week has been insane? I'm going to say more after our first Q&A about the issue of disability and metaphor, but I have a short answer for this one. It's usually fine. Colloquialisms are embedded in language specifically because they are not literally true. I'll try to skip over the boring, long linguistic explanation here, but a metaphor is not meant to be literally indicative of what's happening. It's meant to be figuratively indicative of what's happening. So saying to someone, for example, "Oh yeah, I see what you mean." My best understanding from blind friends, reading literatures in blind studies, and being a low vision person myself, the consensus I'm aware of is that's fine. However, again, other people's mileage may vary. Now, we've come to the time for our first Q&A. We're going to take about 10 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and hop out of my PowerPoint for just a minute and ask Kristen, do we have any questions popping up in the Q&A yet?
We don't yet, and I'm hoping somebody is busy typing as we speak or thinking and about raising their hand because
Great.
I don't see anybody
Yeah,
being
we can hold
brave at the
space for a
moment. It's
minute.
always hard to be first. Oh, someone says they were told handicap accessible was out of date. So there's.
I should have mentioned the word handicap. That's a special one, so to speak. I can speak a little bit to the term handicap. Handicap is a funny term because it is still the term of art in many contexts, including building, architectural, and design contexts. So to say that something is handicap accessible is sometimes literally the best way to say it. Like it means something technical in the world of architecture. It's more common in architecture and building to hear ADA accessible. That stands for Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a little bit of a misnomer because not everything that's labeled ADA accessible is literally ADA accessible according to the letter of the law. But the word handicap accessible, the word handicap in general and handicap accessible is starting to phase out. However, it is not out of date in the sense that it's never used in a technical or legal sense. And the same is true of the term special education. Now, most people in SPED, special education, are aware that special is not necessarily the most contemporary way to refer to their students with disabilities, but that's a term that means something specific within a disciplinary context. So it's still around and in use.
There's a comment saying it's a great start. Thank you. And who are your favorite disability or disability justice thinkers?
Oh, man. So many. I'm going to mention a few that are very much on my mind right now. And then I'm also going to point people to, let me grab the link. Because I am always telling my students about stuff that I've read that I think they should read. I eventually just made a resource list on my website. So I'm going to put that in the chat. It's on my personal WordPress website and it's just the tab called Resources. It's a very large, frankly, highly biased list of what Margaret thinks is interesting. But some of my current favorites include the book The Future is Disabled by Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samarasinghe. I'll put that in the chat. That's someone who I'm really interested in studying closely. Leah's last two books, Care Work and The Future is Disabled, have both come out, a few years ago. Neither is brand new. But They're books of essays, and they offer so much when I go back and read them repeatedly. They're kind of books that are kaleidoscopic. The more you read them, the more you're like, oh, that piece is really speaking to me. That piece is really speaking to me. Eli Clare has a new book titled Unfurl, which I think is just wonderful, but I have to confess, my favorite Eli Clare book is actually his most recent book of poetry, The Marrow's Telling. Really love that book, again, just as something to return to over and over again. And then I'm going to hold up a book to the screen that I'm reading right now. So this is a collection that I'm about halfway through right now. Ugh. My annoying camera that follows me around is making it hard to show the whole book. The book is called The Crypt Linguistics Reader, and it's edited by Octavian Robinson, Aaron Moriarty, and John Henner. And I love this collection because it is talking about language from all kinds of different perspectives, scholarly, personal, signed languages, spoken languages, being non-speaking, written language, augmentative and alternative communication. It's just delicious. It's so good all the way through. So that's one I'm in the middle of right now, and I'm really enjoying it.
Okay, well, there are two questions I'm going to combine here. One is, how would you explain to someone why the R word is a slur? And the other, which is closely related, is what about references to historic programs that have the R word in their title?
Yes. The R word is a specific case because I think a lot of people, including myself, no longer articulate it, which is a special place for a word to be. I'm using the word special all the time. So certain words I simply don't articulate. I consider the word itself to be harmful when heard or written. And so I attempt to signify it instead of saying it or writing it. That's a really imperfect choice. And it's one that I'm always kind of trying to rethink and wonder about, like what are ways to think about and recognize harmful language without redoing the harm? Now, if I were trying to explain to someone why the R word is a slur, it would depend a lot, I think, who that person was. If I were talking to a class of my Introduction to Disability Studies students, I would refer them to the short documentary about activism against the R word. I can't remember the name of it. It's something like A Community Arises. If I Google it later, I'll be able to find it, or someone might be able to contribute it to the Q&A. I might refer them to writing by developmentally disabled people about the R word and why it does and does not matter to them. Or, to be completely honest, in the context of my own classroom, I might say, I don't want to hear that word. I would like to ask you to please not use it directly. If you need to refer to it as the R word. So sometimes in the context of a classroom, I will just say, this is a me thing. However, let's say I'm having dinner with my extended family, and my beloved, well-meaning father-in-law has been like, well, what's the matter with that word? People used to use it all the time. I will probably say, think about something that you don't want to hear. I'll try to offer an analogy to their experience. Is there anything that's hard for you to imagine, hard for you to hear? Just something that you would prefer people treat with gentleness or respect. Now, sometimes a person might be like, nope, I'm fine with anything. And in that case, I might just kind of be like, okay, whatever, you do you. Like, there's a limit to how much I'll try to get into these, I'm here to explain everything for your benefit conversations. But if it is someone I know decently well, I will try to talk about something they might find precious or important, one of their own relations, their spouse, their child, for example. It feels that personal to people to have language that is directed at them as hate speech. So I'll make an effort to analogize it, often along an emotional plane. But again, I'm also pretty willing to cut my losses when having those kinds of conversations. I just don't see it as my job to help everybody in the world think about disability in different ways. I more see it as my job to try to help people get started. Now, in terms of historical terms, that's a great question. There's all kinds of organizations that have anachronistic language built in. One example is the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Colored is not a word that's commonly used in the US anymore, but the NAACP is still the NAACP. There are a number of examples in disability services offices, which are sometimes called anachronistic terms, or sometimes have attempted to jump into the future with names like the Office of All Abilities, which has the disadvantage that then they're kind of hard to find. Different organizations deal with anachronistic language in different ways. And my sense is typically there's an effort to phase it out when possible. So there's a journal called Disability, Handicap, and Society, or rather, it was once called Disability, Handicap, and Society. It's now called Disability and Society, but they haven't gone back and redacted their old issues. They're still published as Disability, Handicap, and Society because the idea is that's part of the historical record, and now we have moved to a different place. Kristen, should we move to the next part and then do Q&A at the end?
I think so, yes.
All right.
There are several questions left, but rest assured we will get to them at
Okay, sounds
the
good.
end.
Let me remember how buttons work. Yay. Okay. So there are a few topics that I've identified for a kind of deep dive. And again, these are based on things that I am asked most frequently, and also the kinds of things that my students and colleagues and I talk about in depth, because these are topics that don't have easy answers. Just gonna see how much time we have. Okay. So one topic that I get asked about a whole lot, in fact, I think this was one of the first things Kristen and I were talking about when we were imagining this workshop, is what about neurodiversity? So some of the terms that I personally am aware of, I'm sure there are many more, include neurodiversity, neuroatypical, neurotypical, neuroweird, neurospicy, neuroqueer. And then there's a lot more. It's become a prefix. Neuro has become a prefix that's just really popular to append to other words to indicate something about neurological difference. Now, interestingly, it doesn't always denote actual neurological difference in the sense of brain chemistry or neurons. Sometimes it indicates a particular way of being in the world that's not technically a brain issue, but is different in a way that might be associated with one's mind or how normative one's behavior is. Some of the internal controversies or specialized controversies around these terms bring in other identity categories, including race and gender. So, for a while, a person that I'm close to, one of my close friends who's white, I am also white, they were using the term neurospicy pretty indiscriminately. It was like just one of their favorite ways to refer to themselves for a while. They were like, yeah, neurospicy, there's a neurospicy community. And then they were informed by another member of our friend group That's a pretty racially specific term. It was appropriated from communities of color. As a white person, you might want to think twice about whether you're going to use the term narrow spicy to refer to yourself. Now, I have not done any research on this. I haven't verified this. And that's typical of a lot of the conversations I have about disability and language. I hear something from one person, they had a conversation with another person. Maybe there's some stuff floating around on Instagram or TikTok. Maybe my students, who are now like some of them are almost 40 years younger than me, are using a term. I don't know what it means. I don't know what the connotations are. There's just not an instruction manual. So that brings us to the second bullet point here, which is okay, so what do I do? The very first thing I would recommend people consider when they're wondering about a term, especially when it's a kind of a language cluster like the neuro cluster, always begin by considering community context, audience, purpose, and respect. So be aware that terms don't live in vacuums, and that not everyone within a particular population, whether it's the US, Ohio State, where I teach, the single classroom where I might be discussing this at any particular moment, there's not going to be a constant to what people think. But if it's a community where people are actively talking about disability and language, there has probably at least been a conversation. Is it possible to access that community conversation? Where might it be located? If one is going to use a term like neuroqueer, consider audience. Is the audience going to understand the term? Will it require explication? Will you need a reference? That is a big part of my purpose when I'm talking. If I'm giving, for example, an academic lecture and I have 40 minutes and I'm really trying to like make a clear argument about my data, unless I need to make a side dive into explaining a term, I'm probably not going to do it. I might identify it and offer a reference in my references page about a way to learn more about that term. But again, the question of educating everybody all the time is one where you kind of have to pick and choose what you're going to talk about when. And absolutely always, and this is one of the few constants I have in my mind about disability and language, always come at it with respect. Try not to ask questions like, oh, is that one of those newfangled terms you kids are using? Okay, I realize no one would say newfangled except me. Try not to be dismissive of language when it's unfamiliar to you or maybe even seems kind of silly. Try to understand that language is highly personal. People are using language the way they are for a reason, whether you like the way they're using it or not. Sometimes it's importantly playful. Sometimes it's importantly attached to their identification. Sometimes their identity is in kind of a delicate, evolving place. This is often true, in particular, with young folks. And so, even if they're discovering a new term every week, they don't need to be belittled for that. They're figuring something out, and that process should be treated with respect. An example from my own long history of trying to deal with the term mental disability. Now, when I wrote my first book, Mad at School, I struggled really hard with what I was going to call the thing I ultimately ended up calling mental disability. And some of the terms that I considered were psychological disabilities, biopsychosocial disabilities, madness, and some of the neuro terms, for example, neuroatypicality. And I considered using mental illness as well until I realized that that left out a lot of cognitive conditions that aren't mental illnesses. It was really a years-long process for me of trying to figure out what was going on there. Kristen, did you just raise your hand? Oh, okay.
By mistake, sorry.
Okay, no worries, no worries. And what I ultimately decided was to go ahead and use the term mental disability based on a couple of things. First of all, a scholar who I rely on a lot in my own field of rhetoric had identified the term mental disability as something that was not a medical term, but a kind of imaginative term. So her name is Cindy Lewicki Wilson, and she pointed out when we use the term mental, we don't necessarily mean something that is cognitive, developmental, intellectual, or any particular medical spot. She was her the point she was making was we tend to associate mental with this more abstract concept of the mind. So mental is a kind of imaginative term. It's a way of pointing toward the mind without getting into extremely specific body parts like brains or extremely specific diagnoses like individual and developmental disability. So I decided I would use mental disability, but I would need to include a caveat in the book. So for me, mental disability is an umbrella term. It's not meant to point to any particular diagnosis or any particular group. Rather, it's meant to point to having something, having a difference with the entity that we call the mind. So it's meant as an umbrella term. Like I identify as mentally disabled, but I also identify as someone who has cognitive disabilities. That's kind of a subgroup under mental disability. I identify as mentally disabled, but I also identify as someone who has been diagnosed with transient schizophrenia. That's a mental illness diagnosis. So mental disability for me is meant as a more inclusive kind of umbrella concept rather than something that's meant to denote anything particular biologically. Whenever you settle on a term, it's going to have costs. So after I published Mad at School, I actually got quite a few responses, emails, even handwritten letters saying that is such an insulting term. Speaking of archaic terms, they're like that term is outdated. It was used to institutionalize people. It's very dangerous. And that's just what happens sometimes with language choices, not only around disability, but around other issues. Coming at something thoughtfully and respectfully doesn't necessarily mean that you will never insult anyone, that you won't frustrate them, that they won't say, "Hey, I would really make a different choice. I really don't like the choice you made," because sometimes that happens. I published an account of that particular process. It's, oh my, that's not what I was trying to do. It's listed here on the references and resources page, Margaret Price, defining mental disability. It was reprinted in the Disability Studies Reader several times, most recently in 2017. But you can also find that in the book Mad at School. Now, here's another deep dive topic that I often am asked about. How do I ask someone what their preferred term is? Question number one in my book is, do you need to know? So, for example, if it's someone that you don't have relations with, you know you're not going to be referring to them in any context in the future, maybe you don't need to know. Maybe what you actually want is to be educated. And the first question to ask when you want any disabled or minoritized person to educate you is, have I done my homework or am I asking them to be my special guide to this topic? It's important to think about that, especially in a time when everyone is so very taxed. It's always okay to want education, but it's good to just take a beat and ask, do I need that person to educate me? Have I thought about whether they have other stuff on their plate? Am I acting like I'm entitled to their time? If you're already in relation with them, And you do need to know, I would recommend waiting for a time that allows them to respond as their best self. Don't ask them when they're surrounded by other people. Don't ask them when they're trying to do something else. Don't ask them when they're in a hurry. Make it clear that you understand that they are the priority with this question, not you. And make it clear that you want to know because you're in relation with them. You're not asking them to be your encyclopedia of all things disability or identity related. You're saying, I am interested in your take on this. And then finally, if you're in a position like teacher, team leader, someone who has the opportunity to establish some kind of structure in a conversation, you can establish a structure that holds space for this question and gives time for response and discussion. So sometimes these are off the cuff conversations, and sometimes they're conversations that occur within more of a set structure. And if you do have the ability to hold some space for questions like, what do you want to be called? It's a great idea to hold space for that in an anticipatory way, instead of always putting the effort on whoever might need to speak up and say, hey, I need to let everyone know something about my disability, identity, name, whatever it might be. And then finally, I think we actually kind of started to talk about this when we talked about terms that are outdated or archaic. What if I'm routinely encountering professional, educational, or medical terms that I don't agree with? So here are just a few that I currently hear all the time in my current job as a director of disability studies that I'm not a big fan of. Abnormal psychology. Again, that's discipline specific. It means something particular. It can't be immediately removed. But I just don't love hearing abnormal every time I talk about these particular psychology classes. Insane. This is very much a pet peeve, and I'm still trying to figure out why I feel this way. I do not mind the word crazy when someone says, oh man, what a crazy week. For some reason, I do mind the word insane. I don't know why. I'm just thinking about it. Special education, like abnormal psychology, is something I hope we can find a way to move away from. But right now, it's doing specific work as a meaningful term in a large educational and research discipline. So it's not something where I would advocate for just change that overnight. I really don't like hearing or seeing the term, I hope you're doing better. Again, that's probably a pet peeve, but for me, as a chronically ill person, if I've been sick, it probably means that I have come out the other end of a constant state of illness where I'm always sick. I was just more sick last week. So again, that's kind of a personal thing, but part of what I'm trying to do here is reveal idiosyncrasies. One of mine is I just really like it when people wish me well or say something like, I hope you're getting good rest. I don't really like to be told that they hope I'm doing better. Again, kind of personal. I really don't like the term burden in terms of work, especially access work. Many of you may be dealing with the new enforcement of the Title II recommendations that are enforcing digital accessibility requirements. Ohio State is really immersed in this right now, and I hear the word burden all day, every day. This places such a burden on faculty. This is such a burden for us. Why isn't the university doing this for us? Well, that's a great question about how institutions operate, but whenever someone refers to access or access work as a burden, there's probably someone hearing them nearby who is thinking, I am that burden. Now, I, Margaret, grown up, cranky, femme, professor, I no longer take it particularly personally when someone refers to access work as a burden, but I know that many of my students do, and I don't want them to have to hear that. And then finally, I'm really realizing this is kind of a list of pet peeves. You're welcome. I don't like the phrase fully accessible. I don't think full accessibility exists. I think that we can describe the ways things are or are not accessible, but saying fully accessible to me indicates that someone is trying to close the book on conversations about whether a space or a process is accessible, rather than saying, let us start a conversation about whether this is accessible. So I'm sort of quietly campaigning to try to urge administrators, instructors, and other folks at OSU to not say fully with regard to accessible, but to say, this is accessible in the following ways, or we have made an effort to make this accessible. If you have further questions, please contact so and so. And I think that brings us to the time for our second Q&A. I have put together some of my favorite references on disability and language to share. Again, you're welcome to write to Kristen for this slide deck, or you can go to the much larger list of general resources that's available on my website. And thank you all so very much for your time today. I'm looking forward to more questions.
Oh, and we have enough that I am not sure if we'll get through all of them. I'm thinking if we don't, is it possible that I could pass them on through email if it
Yes.
comes to that?
Yes, absolutely. I can't promise I'll be able to give long answers, but I can definitely address them.
And I might be able to combine a few of these. It looks like people have common interest in some terms. One talks about a program that they're involved in that is titled Children with Special Healthcare Needs.